Penguin Random House Canada presents The Bright Side, 12 Months, 3 Heartbreaks, and 1 Maybe Miracle by Catherine Bradbury. Read for you by Jessica Porter. For the siblings, Laura, Tim, David, and Anne. Here's to another year, and let's hope it's above ground. Carol Shields, The Stone Diaries. 1. Holes. My house is spitting on me. This bright home with four sides of windows that bring light from every direction, my dear, doted on number 9, has turned against me. I'd like to spit on it, too. I'm lying in bed watching the holes in my ceiling. I don't trust the holes, the way they yawn up into the ceiling, an unsettling sight, into what shouldn't be empty space. The way they pockmark my house. The way their existence creates the piles of rubble I live with, like lumpen dinner guests who never go home. A van rattles up the street, and the hole above my head drops mushroom clouds of plaster dust onto my face. The hole in my ceiling is spitting on my filthy, fuming face. I think I'll close my eyes and picture fields of blooming red poppies turning toward the sun. Or maybe those metallic Alexander Wang shoes I feel I badly need, but decide not to risk it. The plaster dust that coats my bedroom might stick my eyelashes together if I close them for too long. Better to keep my eyes open. I'm having the house rewired. It was necessary after I took out a massive mortgage on an uninsurable, knob and tube-wired fire hazard, and now the massacre that I've invited in provokes and frightens me. 63 holes in the walls and ceilings, 30 heaps of plaster, and one narrow swept path, the kind you should never follow in a fairy tale, to a single connected light dangling from a long black cord over my bed. It's not only the damage the rewiring has done to the house I've rented this past fall for my husband as part of our divorce settlement. He didn't want it, but he didn't think I should have it either. But because, as number 9 becomes rubble, so does my life. I'm a masterful multitasking woman, aren't we all? I book the kids' dentist appointments, plan a dinner party, rip out the front page of the newspaper I run, switch out Justin Trudeau for the stink bug invasion, while biking home from work in my sensible helmet and less sensible shoes. I'm too busy for much self-reflection and not inclined that way anyway. Nothing good ever came of too much thinking. Mom said, whenever she caught me staring into the middle distance, drifting toward some inward call, go out and play. I prefer to do rather than be. I'm with Sartre on that one. Except for the occasional 3 a.m. whirr down a drain of nonspecific dread, I hurtle forward. Or I did, until 2015 began like a hammer to the head. 59 is late for a divorce, and not the wisest time to become the sole owner of a 1940s house badly in need of a lift. And it's not just the house that's falling apart. My parents, both in their 90s, barely add up to one semi-competent person. My brother David, lost to alcohol for 30 years, has come back from the dead, and we're panicked by his improbable return, my mother most of all. Meryl, my oldest friend, has been gone from my life for 20 years, and the absence feels final. I've met a promising new man, but the plaster dust makes him sneeze, and suddenly he's become hard to find. Kelly, my son, has moved across the country to Banff to launch his postgraduate life, and his texts are as fleeting as trilliums. My daughter Mary comes home less often than she might from her nearby photography school, and when she does, she finds me wanting. Mum's sister, Helen, the aunt I most resemble, the one who was meant to go on forever, died a week before Christmas. Even Pierre, our 14-year-old family poodle, is on his last legs. I keep finding him staring into corners, trembling. It's as if everything in my orderly and familiar existence has crowded together at once, only to be smashed apart. The wrecking ball is working overtime. The walls are crumbling, and I don't have a new blueprint. The best I can do is lie in bed as the hours talk from 2 to 3 to 4 a.m. and keep my eye on those holes. Who knows what will come out of them next? 2. Number 9. It was a random girl on a warm spring afternoon who made me realize I would never let go of number 9. Falling for the house was easy and happened all at once. Deciding to hold on to it, even as I left my marriage, that I might have pondered for a moment or two. On the day of the random girl, John and I were in our living room reading or doing not much. The iron casement windows were flung open to catch the first breeze of spring, so we heard the high excitement of the school kids before we saw them come around the corner, holding hands double file. Not two straight Madeline lines, but two stumbling, messy rows of 8 or 10-year-old kids, dawdlers and dreamers, shovers and bossy talkers. The last girl in the row stopped abruptly in front of our house and tugged her partner back. "Oh," she said, staring at number 9. She had dark pigtails and a yellow knapsack, and she stood there until her classmate yanked her away, and even then she looked back with longing. It might have been sweet, except for the greedy hunger in her eyes. "It's mine," I wanted to shout out the window as she lollygagged up the street. The first time John and I saw the house was on a spring day like that one, and I was stopped in my tracks like that girl. I might have even said, "Oh," because seeing number 9 brought me to a decision I hadn't known I was going to make. I loved the way the house sat back from the street with stolid determination. Its white stucco facade and wide symmetrical windows letting you know it had no secrets until you filled it with your own. Its dependable squareness, so different from the stern Victorian houses that jutted into the street like the prow of a ship. Number 9's wide wooden door with its lion's head knocker had the gravitas of a great entry and seemed up to the purpose Edith Wharton described in The Decoration of Houses. Front doors are to let people in and also to keep them out. We moved in with the kids a few months later in 2000, the auspicious turn of the millennium. We had a big mortgage, but good jobs, reliable friends, and for me, the tugboat of the family, a determined and familiar forward momentum that didn't brook disagreement about where we were heading or why. We were on course. That was the important thing, and it had been steady as she goes for some time. Not everything was perfect. We were well into our second decade of marriage and had to navigate around the occasional boulder to have our morning coffee in peace. But moving into number 9 gave us a project, and one we were good at together. We combined handed-down furniture with our own modern splurges in a way that suited us and the house. We knew how to make a place look and feel like home, to provide for ourselves and to welcome friends and family. We painted the wide wooden door bright chartreuse, bought a piano so the kids could learn, they did not, and held martini-fueled parties and smaller talky dinners with good pals. We were in our 40s, that itchy age, said a sexy Ellen Burstyn in the last picture show, and we lived noisy, exciting lives. "How does a woman know when a marriage is over?" asked Carol Shields in the Stone Diaries. Because of the way her life suddenly shears off in just two directions, past and future. I can't say precisely when we began to unravel. It was gradual, but also final. It started before we moved to number 9 and picked up pace once we realized a change of place was not a remedy for a failing marriage. John began to sit alone in the living room with a tumbler of vodka and was mostly silent, which was better than when he was not silent. I stayed late at work. We had ugly arguments that were hard to come back from, and after a while, neither of us tried. Tolstoy's "Each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way" gets a lot of pickup, but I'm not so sure. Unhappiness has a dreary, inescapable sameness, a day-by-day drudgery, and ours was no different. Without knowing it, we were heading for a divorce with all the compromise of a high-speed train. Suddenly, there were no small decisions, only big ones. Would I stay or would I go? "You won't last 5 minutes without me," John said matter-of-factly one morning, sitting in the kitchen at number 9, and I knew it was true. I would literally die without him. Ask unhappy couples why they stay together, and they'll say something similar. I'll die.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?